From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's an exhibit at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts of old photographs from the Old West, and it got us thinking, just how much can a photograph tell us about the past? Like the one in the exhibit of the railroads meeting at Promontory Point, how much does that explain about what was actually going on? The historian Martha Sandweiss says you can tell a lot from what's in an old photo and what's not. We'll be right back.
Hi, it's Nicole Nixon from 45 Days. Every week, Julia Ricci and I break down the latest news and bills coming out of the Utah legislative session. If you enjoy the podcast, you should sign up for the 45 Days newsletter. It's like our show, except it's an email and you read it. Let us send you email. Sign up at 45days.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. At the Utah Museum of Fine Arts on the campus of the University of Utah, there's an exhibition of old and rare photographs. The focus is the railroad. This year's the 150th anniversary of the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad, and that photograph of the two locomotives face-to-face at Promontory Point in Utah in 1869, it's one of the iconic images of the Old West. But when you look at that photograph, or a version of that, there are more than one, of course, what is it you see? What does it actually tell you about the history of building that railroad, or for that matter, the history of the settlement of the American West? Well, the historian Martha Sandweiss says that photograph is a good description, but it's not an explanation. And this is what she does. She takes a photograph and then asks questions like, who's in it? Who's not? Who took the photograph? And what did this person hope to say when he composed it and shot it? Basically, Sandweiss is trying to understand, what is the function of that picture? That's where you get the actual history. Martha Sandweiss is coming to Utah this weekend to talk about what an old photograph can tell us about the past. And today in the program, she's joining us. She's a professor of history at Princeton University. Her work focuses on the American West and on visual culture. And this year, she's a research fellow at Huntington Library in Pasadena, California. There's a slideshow of the photographs we'll be discussing today on our website, radiowest.org. One of the things you mention in one of your books is that your interest began in 1979. And I guess I wanted to go back there. This is when you went to work in a museum in Fort Worth, Texas. This is a leap of faith that you had to take. Do you mind talking about that when you first started getting interested in these photographs?
Sure. I actually went to graduate school to study colonial American history. And then through a peculiar chain of events, largely determined by chance and happenstance, I got offered a job as a curator of photographs at the Amon Carter Museum in Fort Worth, Texas. And honestly, I knew nothing about photographs, but I did know something about Western American history. And I moved to Texas and became a curator in charge of a collection of almost 250,000 photographs. And there's nothing like being in charge, being responsible, and having such an extraordinary collection to help you learn an entirely new subject.
When did you start making these connections about what they tell us about history?
I am by training an historian, so I am used to thinking about all different kinds of primary sources, literary documents or landscapes or buildings or articles of clothing. But thinking about images was something new to me when I began working at the museum. And I had to think hard, what kind of artifacts are these? Are these slices of real life? Is this the past itself? Or do these photographs represent something else entirely?
It's interesting. You say that people often misread old photographs, the meanings of photographs, and because you say the meaning in some ways is rarely self-evident, I wanted to ask you about that. You say sometimes there's this careful logic or an attention to kinds of rules that took place when these photographs were taken, and I just wanted to get your sense of what you mean by that.
Well, photography, no photograph has a fixed single meaning. The photographer might have had something in mind when he or she made the photograph. The subject of the photograph, if it's a person, might have had a different idea in mind for what the photographs would be. People who viewed the photographs later, whether in a gallery, in a newspaper, on the walls of a railroad office, might have approached it with a completely different set of questions and interpreted the photograph differently. So I think it's a mistake to imagine that a photograph just fixes the past in an obvious and self-evident way. It really doesn't. Photographs answer our questions to the extent that we ask them questions. And as our questions change, I think the meanings of these photographs or the apparent meanings of these photographs change as well.
One of the things you mentioned is that our visual literacy often lags behind other forms of literacy, I suppose, like literature, for example. There's a lagging effect there. Explain what you mean.
I think when students in high school, in college, even in graduate school, are very carefully, hopefully very carefully trained in how to interpret literary documents. If it's a diary, they learn to ask one set of questions about the document. If it's a letter, they ask another set of questions. If it's a newspaper article or a published book, they are trained to ask different kinds of questions. What kind of document is this? Why did someone create it? Who saw it? How did it circulate? But very, very rarely are students taught to interpret visual documents with the same kind of care and attention.
Mm-hmm. So I guess what marks the beginning of this history is the invention of the daguerreotype, I guess. That's the first bit of technology. This is what, 1839, I guess it is.
Right. The daguerreotype is the first practical photographic process, and it's introduced in France in 1839. And news of this marvelous new invention quickly spreads to the United States.
Yeah.
So I think we can say that photography and the American West really came of age together in the 19th century. Photography was invented really just as Americans began to move westward from the eastern part of the United States into what becomes the American West. And photography was there to help document that.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned the American West was actually at that particular time, of course, outside of the political boundaries of the United States. So I'm guessing photographers and daguerreotypists, they pretty quickly headed to the West to capture what they could capture there?
Photographers did wander west in the 1840s, and there were just a handful of American photographers with American troops in Mexico between 1846 and 1848. During the war that eventually led to the American acquisition of California and the American Southwest. But photography in the West truly doesn't catch on, I would say really, into the 1860s. Mm. And there are some tremendous technological changes, I think, that help explain why photography, which once had difficulty finding an audience, actually, becomes a more popular medium 15 years later or so.
Why does it have a hard time finding an audience at first?
Well, let's think about what a daguerreotype is. A daguerreotype is a photographic image on a light-sensitized, silver-plated piece of copper.
Yeah.
It's unique. There is no negative for a daguerreotype. If you go out and you do all the work necessary to produce a daguerreotype image, you come away with one. Okay. So daguerreotypes couldn't easily be distributed or sold in large numbers. Daguerreotypes are very small. They're intimate little pictures that you hold in your hand. Mm. So technology matters here because in the 1850s, people invented a process by which photographers could make glass negatives. The technology at the time was called a wet plate negative or a collodion negative. And from that glass negative, which was still very difficult to make, one could make a theoretically unlimited number of positive paper prints, prints on paper.
Yeah.
And then once you were going outside and you did all this work to make a photograph and you could make 10 or 15 or 20 or 100 prints to sell, you began taking more risks and you began making different kinds of photographs because you could distribute them more widely.
So it's interesting. There's a difference between a public photograph in some ways and a private one. Now, you're interested in the public ones, and we'll talk about those. But explain the difference there, because it seems like that's an important distinction.
I think most 19th century photographs, whether made in the West or elsewhere, fall into two categories, what I would call private photographs and what I would call public photographs. It bears saying that, gosh, probably... The vast majority of American photographs made in the 19th century were portraits. Yeah. During the Daguerrean era, so during the 1840s, probably over 95% of American photographs were portraits. These are private pictures. The photographer is making the image for a paying client who is sitting right there in the studio in front of the camera. It's a kind of collaboration between the photographer and the subject. Public pictures, though, were meant to circulate more broadly and to be sold and to be exhibited and to be redrawn as illustrations in newspapers or magazines. And those are quite different. If a private picture is made to satisfy a single sitter, a photographer has to calculate differently when they're making a public photograph, whether it's of railroad construction or a Western landscape or a city or a town or a mining camp. They have to think, what will help me sell the most pictures? How can I make a photograph that people will want to buy? So it's a completely different kind of calculation that goes into making these public pictures.
Yeah. I actually want to come back to this point a little bit later when we talk about the photographs of Native Americans. But let's go back to the idea of the West. What was the draw? What were the images that they were capturing? Because you mentioned, for example, I'm imagining they wanted to show the rest of the country these exotic landscapes and natural wonders. And one of the things you mentioned in your book is that photographs were actual visual evidence of the divine blessing, you say, bestowed upon the country.
It's interesting to think about some of the earliest landscapes made in the American West, because think about it. In the 1840s and the 1850s, Americans living in the Midwest or in the East had seen many, many images of the West, but they had seen them in paintings and they had seen them in inexpensive prints that circulated in all kinds of ways. So people had an idea of what the West looked like. Okay. So then come the photographers. And the photographers, honestly, in some ways, they can't match the fantastic images that people are seeing in paintings and prints. Right. They don't have the same tools. They don't have the same pictorial language that painters and printmakers had. So on the one hand, yes, photographers are, for the very first time, creating photographs of the Rocky Mountains or the Overland Trails or Native American communities in the West. Those are new and those are refreshing for Americans. But on the other hand, Americans had ideas about what the West should look like. Mm. And to some extent, photographers had to meet those expectations.
So there's a conflict or kind of a tension between the American romantic notion of the West and the reality that they were seeing in the photographs?
Well, I think it's complicated to say that photographs present a reality, right?
Yeah, right.
Photographs are not slices of real life. Photographs are works of the imagination. Mm. They're not mere transcriptions of fact. And when I talk about photographs as works of the imagination, I'm asking you to think about the photographer for a minute. Mm-hmm. The photographer has a lot of choices. He, because most of the photographers working outdoors in the American West during the 1860s and 70s were men. He can point his camera this way or that way. He can ask somebody to step out of the frame. He can wait till a certain event is finished and photograph what happens next. So photographs, yes, they capture what's in front of the camera, but don't ever think that they're made without a kind of logic or a kind of planning or intention on the part of the person exposing the plate.
Well, you mentioned the photographer's craft became a storyteller's craft.
Something interesting happens when photographers gain the ability to make photographs on paper. So they're making many, many prints on paper. Mm. Photographic paper is actually very, very thin. So 19th century photographs are virtually always mounted onto board, like cardboard, paper boards.
Right.
And once you're doing that, you can attach words to your photograph. Mm. And this is very, very important. The photographer can tell a viewer how to interpret the scene. The photographer can say, this is the future, or this is America's glorious past, or these native peoples are fated to disappear. A picture can't always tell those stories all by itself. Mm. But when you attach words to it, you can shape and control how a viewer or a buyer reads your picture.
So what you're doing is, I think you described the process as encountering this image in history. So what we're doing is we're looking at the intent of the person who took it. We're looking at circumstances. I mean, there's a lot you have to really sort of work through as you look at that image.
I think there are multiple ways to encounter these images. Of course, I'm going to say this about my fellow historians. Many of my fellow historians and many historical writers only use images as illustrations.
Yeah.
And by that, I mean they've already done the research. They've gone to the archives, the sources, the books, the letters. They've written their story. And a publisher comes along and says, can you illustrate that for us?
Right.
But I am interested in photographs as primary sources, sources that can actually reveal stories to us if we ask the right questions. So yes, I think there are two ways to look at historical photographs. One of them is in history, and the other is through history.
Mm.
When I speak about looking at a photograph in history, I'm saying, let's ask why the photographer was there. Let's ask who paid the photographer to make this picture.
Yeah.
Let's ask how the photographer printed it and distributed it. Let's see if where people saw it and if anyone wrote about it.
Yeah. What's his agenda? What's his idea about society? Because that, I mean, we'll get to some of those particular ideas as we go along here, but that's really important context when we look at a photo.
Right, because many of these photographs that we'll be talking about were works for hire.
Yeah.
So somebody is paying the photographer, perhaps a railroad company, perhaps a government commission, to make these pictures. In other cases, the photographers are carefully calculating what kind of photographs they can make to sell. So in either case, we're talking about photographers who have an agenda, whether it's someone else's or their own.
So when Ken Burns uses photographs in a documentary of some historical moment, like the Civil War, for example, what do you think about that? It seems like in some ways, I guess you're kind of critical of that because that's not really history. He's illustrating. It's not history, I guess, is how you would see that.
When Ken Burns uses photographs in his historical documentaries about the American West or about the Civil War, on the one hand, he does all of us a tremendous service because he really makes his viewers care about these photographs and he makes people curious about these photographs. On the other hand, he is largely using these photographs as illustrations. Mm. And sometimes that makes for some slips in the accuracy of his historical narrative. For example, you might hear one Civil War soldier's letter being read out loud, but the face that you see on the screen may not be the author of that letter.
Right.
Or there's some examples in his series on the West where he follows the drama of a family moving west across the Overland Trails, but the family that he returns to repeatedly in his image, focusing on the mother, the child, the father, is not the family he's talking about. In fact, the family that he's talking about moved west before photography was invented.
Yeah.
So I understand how it becomes a powerful storytelling crutch for him. But I'll say it, it's not always 100% accurate historically.
But it's, I guess it's tempting, though, to use these photographs to evoke these images. But it makes me think about something you've written about, for example, the just how accurate the photographs we have of the old cowboys. Because you mention in your book that the majority of cowboy photographs we have came after the end of ranching on the open plains. So it seems like a lot of that is you have to take with a grain of salt. These aren't necessarily accurate portrayals of what old cowboys looked like.
You know, we talk about the agendas that a particular photographer might have, but we can also speak about the agenda that a particular photographic subject might have.
Right.
And yes, long after open range cattle ranching was over and the cattle industry begins to change, we continue to see ranch hands dressing up like old-time cowboys for their photographs. So it's not just people today who might be caught up with the romance of the Old West. There were people in the 19th century who very much missed a world that they thought had just disappeared.
That's Martha Sandweiss. She's an historian and author of the book Print the Legend. She's going to be here this Saturday morning at 11, a guest of the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. Her lecture is called Discovering History Through a Photograph. It's part of the museum's celebration of the 150th anniversary of the Transcontinental Railroad and their photography exhibit, The Race to Promontory. The lecture, admission to the museum, all of that is free, by the way. You can get information on our website and see a slideshow of the photographs we'll be talking about on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
Support for KUER comes from local and national businesses across Utah. As a corporate underwriter, your business can support the news, information, and conversations you hear every day on KUER. And our loyal, active listeners will hear about your company and the work it's doing in our community. To learn more about becoming an underwriter, go to KUER.org and click Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're asking, how much can a photograph tell us about the past? Like the one at the exhibit at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts of the railroads meeting at Promontory Point. How much does that explain about what was actually going on? Our guest is the historian Martha Sandweiss, and her specialty is old photographs. She says, you can tell a lot from what's in an old photo, but also what's not. She's coming to Utah this weekend. We'll give you details about that a little bit later on the program. She joined us from Huntington Library in Pasadena, California. Well, I want to get to a particular image. Let's talk about the one at the heart of the lecture you're going to be giving. You're also writing a book about this image.
Right. I'm trying to write an entire book about a single photograph made in 1868.
Yeah. Well, not only a single photograph, but one that you've actually described as rather banal. Let's talk about what interests you about. We'll break it down as we go. But what interests you about this particular image, just on the face of it?
Let me describe the photograph I'm writing about. You see six tall white men standing to either side of a young Native American girl. Three men on one side of her, three men on the other side of her. And it's a very formal picture. The men, it's not exactly a straight line. They're in the slightest of curves with the girl in the middle. And the two men on the side look one way, the two men in the middle on each side look another way, and the two men on either side of the girl look at one another right over her head.
Yeah.
Only the little girl, who's wrapped tightly in a blanket, a trade blanket, look straight ahead at the photographer. It's a very formal picture and a weirdly formal picture.
Yeah, weirdly. I have to say, it looks almost creepy when you see it.
Well, I don't know if I would call it creepy, but I'll tell you what attracted me to the picture. My last book was about a Western explorer named Clarence King, who had a secret double life. And I found that as a scholar, I had a lot of fun just plunging into the archives and finding the traces of a life that no one wanted me to find.
Yeah.
And it made me curious. Could I go back to some 19th century photographs that have unidentified people in them and figure out who they were?
Right.
Because tracking down people who didn't necessarily expect to be found is a lot of fun. I sometimes say that being a historian is like being a detective and a journalist all wrapped up in one.
Yeah.
So in the photograph that I'm writing about, the six men are very well-known figures. One of them is General Sherman, who everybody will have heard of for his role in the Civil War. Another is a well-known abolitionist. There are some other men there who were involved in the Civil War as military leaders. And on every copy of this picture that I've seen, their names are carefully written at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
But the photographer, I don't think, knew the name of the little girl. And she remained anonymous in the archives for over 100 years. And I now, I think, have figured out who she is. And I'm trying to recover her history and make her a person who matters just as much as those tall military figures standing around her.
Yeah. We'll get to her in a moment. Let's talk about the photographer. This is Alexander Gardner. You say he was a man who had big ideas, and for the time he had some kind of radical social thoughts.
Alexander Gardner was born in Scotland, and he first began thinking about moving to the United States in the early 1850s with a group of family and friends who wanted to create a utopian colony on the Iowa frontier, of all places. Mm-hmm. But the company went on to Iowa before him. He stayed behind to tend to some business things and to deal with some family matters. And by the time he emigrated to the United States later in the 1850s, that hopeful little colony had failed in the face of the reality of an Iowa winter.
Mm-hmm.
So he ends up in New York. He begins working for the great photographer Matthew Brady. He later ends up in Washington, D.C. He's one of the great photographers of the Civil War.
Right.
He photographs Lincoln. He photographs the execution of the Lincoln conspirators in 1865. And then in 1867, he heads west with a railroad survey. And in 1868, we find him at Fort Laramie, documenting the work of the peace commissioners who stand there beside the little girl in my photograph.
Yeah. This was 3 years after the Civil War, but you say it's still the Civil War is still part of the story in that photograph. And that, in fact, this is how you put it. You say this photograph is part of a larger story that touched every American's life. There's race in here. There's a lot of social components. Talk a little bit about that, what you see contained in that photo.
What I'm doing with this photograph is a little bit odd. I'm going to prove to my readers that I know these people better than the photographer did. And that sounds odd. That sounds arrogant. Alexander Gardner met these people. He knew what they sounded like or smelled like or ate for breakfast. But I know what happens to these people when they walk away. And I know what their lives were like before they encountered Alexander Gardner. So what I'm really doing in this project is following all seven people in the picture and the photographer to this patch of hard-packed dirt outside a military fort in what's now Wyoming, and then I'm going to watch them walk away. And when you do that, you see amazing stories all colliding there in this single photograph. The oldest person in this picture was born in 1800. The youngest died in 1936. So imagine Thomas Jefferson meeting Franklin Roosevelt.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what's going on in this photograph. It just shows us how short American history is.
You say it. This rather simple photo embodies the central questions of American life. So what do you see of slavery in that photo? There's no African-American. There's an Indian girl. There are famous Americans, but what do you see of slavery in that photo?
Right, we don't see any African Americans in this photograph, But Reconstruction is the backdrop for this photograph.
Yeah.
And the Civil War is the historical background of this photograph. The men in this photograph have all had experience with slavery. One of them, General William Harney, one of the very few Union generals to have actually been a slaveholder himself, had murdered a family slave in the 1830s and gotten away with it.
Wow.
William Tecumseh Sherman helped lead an army that was going to end slavery and allow African Americans to be freed people in the United States. But he didn't trust African Americans. He didn't really want them fighting in his army. He wanted them to be laborers instead.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of the men in the picture, Samuel Tappan, is a well-known abolitionist who had fought slavery all his life. So here are these men. Enslaved people have just been freed a few years before, and these men are out west trying to figure out what to do with Indian peoples. And I think in their mind, they've taken the racial views formulated in one context with regard to African Americans and taken those views west with them. Some of them are very sympathetic to Indian culture. Others are quite judgmental and harsh towards the Indians, just as they had been judgmental and harsh towards the freed people in the South.
What is it about the girl? You've come to find out that her name is Sophie Rousseau. You say it's her life that draws you in the most. What can you say that you feel comfortable revealing now about her and her life?
You know, children and women are so often consigned to the dustbin of history because they don't always generate the same kinds of literary records that men do, especially men of a particular social class. And certainly all of the men in my photograph are of a particular social class. But little Sophie in this picture has an extraordinary life. As I've plunged into it, I've discovered that her mother is Lakota. Her father is a French-Canadian trader. They met at Fort Laramie in the 1850s. They were married for over half a century. I've discovered that little Sophie has an uncle who was the Prime Minister of Quebec.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's so easy to look at her in this photograph and say, oh, she's small, she's dark, she's a girl, she's young. But she's as connected as the military men that stand beside her there. She has an extraordinary life. She grows up in a mixed-race family. She ends up marrying a white Civil War veteran. Mm. He falls in love with a white woman. He kidnaps his mixed-race children and sends Sophie, then a young woman, to the newly created reservation in Pine Ridge, South Dakota. She marries a mixed-race man and has another family and lives out of her life on that Indian reservation.
Wow. And lives to be fairly old, I think, as I recall. You mentioned
She was born in around 1860 and she dies in 1936. So
wow.
Yeah, 76 years old.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, this is interesting, you say photographers pictured Native people, this is how you put it in your book, largely to show that they would soon fade before the mm-hmm. superior culture of the expanding United States. And this gets us to this motif, I guess, of Indians being perceived as this vanishing race, literally called in one photograph, I think from like 1907 or something like that, the vanishing race. Talk about that.
Photographs tell stories, and photographs that are made to be sold have to tell stories that will attract buyers. So in the very earliest days of the photography of American Indians during the Daguerrean era in the 1840s and into the 1850s, many of the portraits made of Indian peoples were made for those people. Let's not sell the subjects of these pictures short. Indian peoples could understand what a portrait was and why it would be of value to them as a portrait of their families or their trip to wherever. But as photographers begin to make paper photographs of Indian peoples, they are making photographs that reinforce the stereotypes that a broader American public has. And you're absolutely right. The big stereotype of Indian peoples and sort of the wishful thinking on the part of many Americans is that they would disappear in the face of the superior technology and civilization of white Americans.
There's this these myths that develop. This was interesting. Native Americans, this idea that they were superstitious. You know, this idea, and I still hear this from time to time, that these Native Americans believed if you took their picture, it would, you know, you would steal their soul. That myth starts to emerge around this time, I guess.
You know, there's lots of myths about what Indian peoples thought about photography, and certainly one of the ones I've heard quite a lot is that people believed photography would steal their soul and perhaps contribute to their death. But when you really plunge into it, you find that that is just a stereotypical way of thinking.
Yeah.
Every tribe encountered photography in a different way. Every tribe formulated its own ideas about photography. And you can actually trace that through some of the words that different tribal languages use to describe photographs and photographers.
So when we look at photographs of Native Americans, old historical photographs, can we say much about, I mean, I'm thinking about the ones that were posed, the ones mm-hmm. where they're almost costumed. Can these photographs really say that much to us about actual Native Americans?
Well, I think that actually many, many fewer 19th century portraits of Indian peoples depict them in costumes than people think. Huh. The vast, vast majority of these portraits show people wearing their own clothes. So let's just put that out there.
Yeah.
It's also important to note that basically throughout the 19th century until the very, very end of the century when snapshots are invented, a portrait is a collaboration of sorts. The photographer is working there with a big camera. It's set on a tripod. It's not a quick snapshot. Everything has to be carefully lit and arranged. So these are not what I would call stolen pictures. It's not like sneaking your iPhone somewhere where you're not supposed to be and illicitly snapping a picture. These are, to some extent, collaborations. That said, the native subject of these portraits may have a completely and different ambition for the picture than the photographer.
Right.
So the subject may think, I am posing for a picture that I can give to my grandson, and it's really going to be great to have this around. But the photographer may say, I am going to make multiple prints of this, contribute it to a government archive, and see that it's part of a government catalog, which was in fact published, that talks about the vanishing race and makes the argument that the only good Indian is an Indian who's given up his or her traditional culture and assimilated into more mainstream American life. And those two meanings of the picture can exist at the same time. It just depends who owns it and who's looking at it.
Well, it's interesting. One of the things you've written about is that you're, in fact, more interested in what we do with these images now than maybe even how they were received back then. Would you say something about that?
Well, I'm interested both in how the pictures were received then, but we live now. We have our own questions now.
Yeah.
So I think we have to be very mindful about how we approach these photographs. They don't exist just for us. They had meanings then, and we have to be attentive to those meanings even as we search for new kinds of meaning now.
And I wanted to point this out. It's something you mentioned about, not to pick on Ken Burns, but one of the things that you've said is that some of the images of Native Americans in Ken Burns films, you know, they use these kind of generic images of a Native American as if, as you've explained, Native Americans just were static, that they didn't change, that they didn't make progress, or they didn't adapt over time. And that's an That's a stereotype. That's an unrealistic character.
Right. I think one of the most egregious misuses of photographic evidence in one of the Burns documentaries comes in his series about the American West. And it comes from a moment where he's describing the very successful Pueblo Revolt of 1680, in which Pueblo peoples really across what's now New Mexico rose up and against the Spaniards who were there, and threw them out of the territory, threw them out of the colony for at least 12 years. When Burns narrates this very dramatic story, and it's a story of the most successful Native revolt in North American history, he visualizes it by using a film from a Hopi snake dance shot in the early 20th century. Now, the Hopi snake dance is one of the most exotic and kind of, to most people, scary, terrible kind of images you can imagine, because the dancers are carrying rattlesnakes in their mouths. So by using that film footage, he is suggesting to most people that they are watching the very Indians who rose up in 1680, you know, of course not, he's off by over two centuries, to throw out the Spanish. And he's making Native people seem terrifying in some way, instead of, in this case, clever, resourceful, and well-organized.
Let's shift to the spring of 1869. The Transcontinental Railroad finally completed. The two tracks, of course, meet up at Promontory Point in Utah. This is, of course, that iconic photograph that most people are familiar with. Let's talk about that photograph. There's more than just one, of course. Turns out there were three photographers there that day.
Yeah, and those are interesting photographs, because let's just talk about the most famous one, where you see the two locomotives that have been detached from the trains. The locomotives are moved, so they're sort of snout to snout there on the track. Yeah. There's engineers with bottles of champagne toasting one another on the front of the locomotive cars. Those photographs describe, but they can't explain that moment. Yeah. They document the end, but they cannot explain to us the means. And by that, I mean, when you look at those pictures, you can't tell how those railroads were built. You can't tell that the labor to construct the Central Pacific Railroad, which moved from California east towards Promontory Point, that the labor was done by Chinese workers, because there are no Chinese workers in that picture. Some of them have been sent back to do some track maintenance farther west. Those that remained are off celebrating on their own in a nearby railroad car. So the picture describes a particular celebratory moment, but it does not explain how we got to that moment.
Yeah. The photographs you say in your book didn't really, I'm just wondering about what they intended for that. You say they didn't really speak to the past so much as the future that was yet to unfold. Is that how you put it?
Yeah, there's something so ironic about photography. Think about it for a moment. The moment you've taken a picture, that moment is past, right? Your photograph is always about something that's over and cannot be recovered. Mm. But for photographers working in the American West in the 19th century, and I mean here the photographers working on to document the railroad as well as those documenting the government surveys of the West, they are concerned with the future. They are concerned with what will be. And I think your listeners who are able to see the exhibition at the museum will note that these photographs of the railroads are all about progress. They're all about how this area will become more American, how the remaining Native peoples will disappear, how American progress will prevail at all costs. So a medium that documents the past is used by photographers to predict a future.
Hmm. There's another image from the exhibit that I wanted to ask you about. This is, I guess this is the title, Indian Viewing Railroad from Top of Palisades.
Right. Let me describe that photograph for your listeners. It's it's a stereograph.
Right.
That means it's a two-part image that was made with a camera that has two very close together lenses. And you would, it's as if you're looking at it with your own eye. If you look through your right eye, you see one thing. Your left eye, you see another thing. You focus your eyes together, and you see the world three-dimensionally.
Yeah.
That's how stereographs work. So this is a small image that was designed to be seen in a stereo viewer, something that you would hold in front of your eyes. You would merge the two images and see a three-dimensional picture. So what does it show? In the immediate foreground is a Native American man dressed in what appears to be traditional garb. It's a little hard to tell what it is. Yeah. And he's looking out into a valley through which there is a newly laid railroad track. Photographers in cases like this were borrowing from a kind of iconography that had already been developed by painters and printmakers. The idea was the railroad track is the future, this Indian man is the past, and all he can do here in this picture is gaze on at the inevitability of it all. He will fade away, and the trains will come through.
Yeah. Well, we should mention Alfred Hart, who took the picture. He used to be a painter, so he's obviously familiar with these motifs. And you say he used these visual metaphors in his work.
I think all photographers had to use these visual metaphors because the public was used to very descriptive paintings. Let's talk for just a second about what paintings and prints can do that photography can't. Yeah. First of all, they can use color. Photographers in the 19th century can't do that. And painters and printmakers can combine things that happened over a long period of history. You can show somebody being shot and dying and is being buried all in one single painting. Yeah. And a photographer can't compress time like that. And painters could depict somebody on the peak of the Rocky Mountains looking at California. Well, obviously no photographer could depict California from the top of a peak in the Rocky Mountains. So photographers had to figure out how can we compete against these other kinds of visual storytelling, and they often borrowed motifs from painters.
That competition is interesting, I have to say. They're, 'cause it was about the commercial interest, right? I mean, they and as I guess as you said, that maybe that gets to why there wasn't interest about in those photographs, at least in those early days, maybe.
Well, I think when we're speaking about the railroad photographs, sure, Americans know that the railroad is being built. They're reading stories about it in the newspapers. If they're following congressional debates, they know there's conversations about how these technological marvels are being funded. If they follow military debates, they know that the military is out west trying to push Native peoples onto reservations to clear a path for the railroad to go through. And certainly that's part of the background of the photograph I'm writing about.
Yeah.
So people knew about the railroads, and these photographs showed them the railroads.
Right. How do you think, Professor, about photographs that come to many of us these days in digital form? We're browsing the internet. 'Cause you say it's no longer a physical record of the moment. So how are you thinking about the difference in the way we experience those?
I love old photographs. I love how they feel. I love how they look. I love turning them over to see what somebody wrote on the back, you know, Aunt Mamie at Yosemite or something like that. I love being able to tell something about the photograph by its size. If it's really big, I know it was created to be sold and exhibited. If it's very small, it might have been a private picture for a particular sitter. If it's a stereograph, I know it was part of a series that was sold to large numbers of people. But when you encounter that photograph online, you really can't tell. You can't always tell how big it was. You can't always tell if anything got written on the back. You can't always tell what kind of board it's mounted on. So when these 19th century photographs are sort of re-presented in digital form, so much information is lost. And they become really just pictures instead of historical artifacts.
Yeah. It's a good pitch to get people to come to the exhibit itself. And I was thinking about people wandering around looking at these photographs. And I'll ask you about this finally, because one of the things you say is that ultimately in your work, ultimately one of the greatest values of photographs, you say, is not the physical information they convey, but the stories they elicit from the viewers. Say something about that finally, if you would.
Photographs are a tremendous spark to the historical imagination. I think they have the capacity to help us feel a spark of empathy between our own time and a distant time, between us and people we will never get to know. We look at these pictures and we go, these are people just like we are people. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't always know what those people from the 19th century are thinking. It's a mistake to imagine that because our face looks one way when we feel sad, that their face looked that way when they felt sad. We shouldn't make that link. But there's something about seeing people in the past. There's something about seeing familiar places as they existed 150 years ago that I think just enlarges us as people and makes us think about time and our own place in time. Old photographs are tricky. Not everything was photographed, of course, and there's always the danger that because something exists in a photograph, we make it more important than it really should be, and we forget about things that never were photographed. But I think it's that creation of, really, I'm just going to say the spark of empathy between our time and theirs that's very, very powerful.
Martha Sandweiss is a professor of history at Princeton University. And on Saturday morning at 11, she's going to be here in Utah speaking at the Utah Museum of Fine Arts at the University of Utah. She's giving a lecture in conjunction with their photography exhibit there. And admission to the museum, to the lecture, it's free all day on Saturday. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org, and you can see some of the photographs we talked about during the conversation there as well. Radio West is a production of KUER News. The program directed by Tim Slover, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.